listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5. This is Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living, and you're listening to our radio show, Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth. Today we have on Susan Senator. She is the author of Making Peace with Autism, One Family's Story of Struggle, Discovery, and Unexpected Gifts. So Susan is the mother of three boys, Nat, who's 15, Max, 13, and Ben, 7. Nat was diagnosed with autism at 3 years of age. Back then, they were told by the evaluating pediatrician that there was no recommended treatment for autism, just many schools of thought, but that they would know when something was working. In the last 12 years, she found the statement both maddening and empowering. Ultimately, she believes that she and her husband are the experts on Nat and his best advocates, but the road has not always been smooth. She does believe she can safely say, however, that they are a reasonably happy family in spite of the autism and that each family member, including Nat, is an integral part of the family. They live in Massachusetts. They've been married for 21 years and have gone to college together at Penn and moved up north after she finished her master's degree. Ned, her husband, is a software engineer, and Susan is a writer with works published in places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, Education Week, and Family Fun. Susan serves on the school committee, Board of Education in her town, where she focuses on issues of curriculum, special education, gifted and talented education, and legislative matters. Making Peace with Autism is her first book. Susan, it's great to have you here today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm very excited because this is obviously a topic that is very near to many of my clients, and I think it's a perspective that we don't necessarily spend a lot of time on. I'm always so focused on the biochemical aspects and all of that, but I think that it is crucial that we balance the whole being by understanding the other pieces to autism, what it takes to be a family with autism and to work through the challenges and the struggles and all of that. So I'm really excited to have you here today.
Thanks.
So when did you first know that something was wrong with Nat?
Well, for me, it was a feeling almost immediately when we brought him home from the hospital, and I just had the feeling that something was kind of off between us. It was sort of like I described it to myself, like, he didn't quite need me, even though he made his needs clear by crying and that kind of thing. It just felt like something wasn't quite right, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And that was just even, like, the earliest days.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of parents, it takes them a while before they kind of figure it out, or it seems to be progressing along normally before they notice that something's wrong or that something changes. So you noticed basically from the very beginning that there was just something that wasn't quite right?
I did, but I didn't believe in it. I mm-hmm. didn't believe in my judgments because everyone else around me was very reassuring that he was fine and he was just himself and mm-hmm. every child is different and all those kinds of things, which are true, mm-hmm. but in Nat's case, it was not true. And my husband was more like what you described. He became aware of it, many months later,
mm-hmm.
when Nat couldn't hold up a bottle by himself without just being put on his back.
Mm. Maybe you can describe a little bit of what Nat's kind of, to describe him, what is he like, when these things were first happening, what wasn't quite working?
Well, it was subtle. There were things that were more obvious, like he startled a lot as an infant, and I asked my sister what was this all about. She was a medical student at the time, so she knew a little bit, and explained to me that it was a normal infant reflex, but it seemed like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was just this, it was really, it was a feeling of not quite being needed by my own baby. So at the same time, I thought how stupid that is that I would feel that way.
Right.
So it was really hard to tune in to what I was actually seeing as being signs of a lack of, I wouldn't say a lack of a bond, but definitely there was just that sort of withdrawn sense that people with autism sometimes do have, mm-hmm. and I was seeing it in a very, very early stage. It wasn't until he was two that, you know, he had most of his, he had all the milestones on time, but at two, when kids become much more social finally, that we could really see in a pronounced way that he wouldn't get out of the stroller at the playground and cried around other children, wouldn't enter rooms that were unfamiliar without a big tantrum.
Mm-hmm.
So at two, when social stuff begins, that's when we both, my husband and I, really became much more sure.
Right. When did you get the diagnosis? Was it shortly after that?
It was about a year after. So it was when he was three already, because even then the pediatrician didn't believe us and felt that he was just a genius because he had memorized his childhood books and could quote from them.
Right.
So she wasn't seeing that as being odd, just wonderful. And so what we did finally was we got a checklist together from a book, the American Academy of Pediatrics 0 to 5, which is still around, and it had a checklist of all the different areas of what a child that age should be doing, and so I could actually see what he was and wasn't doing and brought it into her, and by three, so that was at 2.5, and by three we had our appointment.
What did the doctor, what was the doctor's official diagnosis, and then what advice did he give you?
Well, that was the developmental pediatrician, and he said that it was something called PDD, pervasive developmental delay, under the autism umbrella, and he basically said it's a form of autism, it's a mild form of autism, and what he said was things like my son probably won't go to college or be able to get married, and things like that. And he also said, but then again, all bets are off because nobody really knows with these kids what the right education could do for them.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, basically, what you really need to do is find him the right program right away.
Hmm. And did you get any guidance with that? Did you find the, quote, right program?
Well, he's the one who said, you'll know right away if it's working or
right.
not. And being in shock, I didn't question what that would mean, what that would look like. But I just assumed that I would know, and we took that to heart. And we didn't find the right program right away. We went along with what our school system recommended, which was just a special education classroom with kids with mixed needs,
mm-hmm.
And maybe about 15 kids with three teachers. Just, you know, not a very good ratio for someone of Nat's needs. And, you know, he was there for about a year until we realized that he really needed something far more intense, and we found a program that had that was a private program, and got him in by the time he was five.
Hmm. And that, did you see a big turnaround at that point?
Yeah, that was quite wonderful because almost immediately, when we took him to the intake interview there, they demonstrated the behavioral approach on him, and showed him. She gave him a command, and she said, "Nat, come here." And he didn't answer her. And then she moved him gently to the spot, and he went and put him back. And then she said, "Nat, come here." And then he did it.
Hmm.
And it was just amazing to see him actually respond to a command
wow.
for the first time. So, you know, we knew this was a good approach for him. I know it's not for everyone, but it's certainly behavioral approaches certainly do have their merits for a lot of these kids.
Mm-hmm. And just for listeners out there that have tried a lot of things or are thinking about trying some things, is it a school of thought that people have heard of? Is it something that is unique to this particular school?
Oh, yeah. Behaviorism is pretty widely well thought of. It's also known as ABA, Applied Behavioral Analysis. And there's been some good data showing that this kind of intensive approach, positive reinforcement
mm-hmm.
and behavioral modification. And with that kind of approach, usually in a one-to-one setting, you can really teach a child with autism a lot of really great skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have many clients that are doing ABA or have done it and have seen some really great results from it, so I'm glad to hear. It was a school, was it, that used the ABA as their kind of primary teaching method? Is that kind of what it was? Because
yeah.
I know some of my clients will do, you know, private one-on-one ABA therapy in their home. This was more in a school setting with several children?
Right. This actually was a preschool that had a few typically developing children as well, so that Nat had some typical peer models that he was sometimes paired up with. But for the most part, the main thrust of it was to do the behavioral stuff. And, in fact, I did get some home-based therapy from the school in his first year there, which was terrific.
Hmm.
So we really haven't had to do much of the private ABA, you know, pay for that on our own.
Right. Well, that's great that you have that resource available to you. I'm curious from, because, you know, your book goes a lot into kind of what it was like for you and for the family, and, you know, you have two other children as well. After getting the diagnosis of autism, what were the emotional stages that you went through? I think that's probably pretty important, because we always go into what action are we going to take, but we kind of miss that piece of it. So I'm curious, that, you know, maybe you can assist some others out there. What was that process for you? How long did it take you? Was it, you know, 3 days? Was it a month? Was it a year? I'm just sort of curious, if you don't mind.
I'd say it was like many months before I felt like really taking action. I certainly did go to the library almost immediately, but it was with such a heavy heart, and, you know, I mean, I think I was in a daze and so depressed for months. But I still tried to go about my usual routines. Like I said, I went to the library. I took my baby, Max, my second child. I took him to the park. You know, I did all the errands I had to do. But I didn't start to feel like I could really act until, you know, I think a few months of that had gone by. And then I found myself a support group. That was run by the local Association of Retarded Citizens, the ARC.
Okay.
This was a bunch of parents that were just like me, and I just couldn't believe my ears hearing similar stories of diagnoses that had been missed by doctors or by the parent themselves, and all the guilt people felt, and the confusion about what program to try. And it was just a huge learning experience. It was wonderful, and I met a friend there that I'm still friends with 12 years later.
Wow.
And that was really where I got my biggest education. My husband didn't go with me, so that was sort of like I had to help him myself. I kind of took home stories from the support group to my husband and found a way of talking and getting him to talk about his feelings, since he doesn't generally talk that much about his feelings. He's not the way I am.
Right.
So this kind of, the support group was a way to start talking about it together.
That is really, I think, a really powerful piece, because I think a lot of times what people don't realize is that, you know, before you can get to action, there is some sort of a grief process that you need to go through. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes that's hard for people to acknowledge.
Right.
Because, you know, of course you love your child and you wouldn't have it any other way, but at the same time you have a right to be, you know, grieve for what you're, you know, the new information that you're finding out.
Right.
And I think that, you know, that's actually really helped a lot of my clients. And I know that it can be tough on a marriage, too. And, you know, how did you and Ned get through that? Were there... I hear that the divorce rate is pretty high with parents of children with autism, and because I can imagine the stress that people are undergoing. And I'm curious, what did you learn? What can you offer other people as far as kind of how do you? I guess there's a couple pieces. There's the piece about, you know, what did you do, you know, with regard to just family in general, and then it was specifically with marriage relationship. How did you work through that? So I don't know if you have a place you want to start, or if you want me to be more specific.
I guess the best thing that we did, I know, was to work as a team, I don't think we consciously knew that we were doing that. You know, I just think that we just pulled together after a bit, after a sense of realizing that we had really been apart and seeing different things, and in a big disagreement up until the diagnosis. After the diagnosis, it was acknowledged. We didn't acknowledge it out loud, but I had been right, and I then sort of became the catalyst for action. In other words, our relationship changed. I developed more confidence after that, even though it was out of a terrible thing, like my child being autistic. I developed more confidence to go out and find information and go to a support group and get therapy and bring it home to my husband and make him talk about it. But more than that, I think he came around and found his own ways of contributing to the work that had to be done around Nat.
Mm-hmm.
So he found that while I was at support group, he gave the kids baths, and he bonded with them like a daddy.
Mm.
And he found he's always been better at sort of physical play. So he played with them, and he kind of kept things light. And he's very buoyant anyway, and we found ways to even... Sometimes, I know this sounds bizarre, but we found ways to laugh about it.
Mm-hmm.
It probably started by talking about some of the people in the support group and, you know, just how similar they were to us or how different, and we kind of built a culture of fighting the autism together. And then out of that came dividing up the labor, and I became good at making the doctor's appointments and going to them and bringing back the information, and he became better at bringing... Nat to sport activities and social things, and you know, we just kind of figured out what each one was good at, and
mm-hmm.
so we worked as a team, and we also kind of worked according to our own strengths.
When you talked about the other children, obviously that I think can be really hard to balance between, you know, you have one that's taking so much attention, and yet obviously the other ones have a need for equal amount of attention, or you know, their share of attention as well. How did you what can you tell parents about maybe some things that they can do, some ideas or some ways of interacting or kind of keeping the family whole and keeping it as balanced as possible?
Well, I think it's a good thing to kind of take a few things, figure out a few things that are important to you as a family. Like, what do you want to do and be like as a family? And if you have like two or three things, you know, then you can find a way to kind of eventually do them.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you're not trying to do everything. I realized, for instance, a while ago, what I wanted the most was for us to be able to take vacations together. So while I knew we weren't going to be a family that went back then, let's say when Nat was five and Max was three, we weren't going to be a family that went to the Red Sox game or the ball game
mm-hmm.
together. I didn't know how to make that happen, but I knew that we were going to be a family that took vacations. Mm-hmm. So we figured out how to do that. We went on vacations with my parents, who were a real big source of support for us, and we found ways to make that fun. And in terms of what about the other two boys now, Ben, who's 7, and Max, who's 13? Well, another thing we decided a long time ago was, well, this is our family. The family's the priority. We have to give some things up in order to make our family work.
Mm-hmm.
So what I give up is some free time of my own and focus on Nat, Max, and Ben
mm-hmm.
so that I really make sure I have enough time and energy for each of them.
Right. And it sounds like you found a way to make that work.
I have. I mean, you know, it's hard because I do work and my husband works and we get tired. So, you know, one thing that we do is we make sure at the end of the day, you know, that there's like one or two things that we've done with each boy
mm-hmm.
so that when I go to sleep at night, I can feel like, okay, I had a nice interaction with Nat today. I played with Ben. I played that hide-and-seek game, even though I was tired.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with Max, we took time just to talk a little bit about the latest Star Wars movie. You know, it doesn't have to be like you go to a museum together. it's got to be just, you know, you think about what each boy needs, and you try to give them that, even just a few minutes each day.
Right.
I think they feel special. I think they feel it.
Yeah, sure. It's almost like meditation, like just being present in the moment with what you're doing and having just that, you know, whether it's smelling a flower or, like you said, having whatever the interaction with the child is, it making that interaction special. And it probably, I don't know, but I would guess on some level, you may even have more individual interactions because you're really making a conscious effort to do so. Is that...
Yeah.
Do you find that true?
I think that's really true. I think that we've both, my husband and I, have kind of come to have a very good perspective about what our lives are right now, and it's all about the family, and it's work and family, and there isn't a lot of time for other stuff, but, you know, that's kind of, we have young children, and that's kind of what our priority is, and we convey that, and I think we try not to take those small moments for granted. Any small triumph, we try to recognize. And,
mm-hmm.
and it's like you said, it is about living in the moment.
Yeah. What are some of the best ideas you and Ned have had that you can share with people?
I think the best thing we ever did was something I call them the Nat books, or sometimes I call them crisis stories. And what they are, they're basically social stories that are that we made into books. They're little books that are personalized about Nat or Max or Ben, with pictures of them that are about trying to get them through any event that might be difficult. Like the first one we ever did was Nat's Thanksgiving, and it wasn't about pilgrims and Indians and all that. It was about, how does Nat do Thanksgiving?
Mm-hmm.
What's Thanksgiving going to feel like? Who's going to be there? And we tried to have pictures of the people and the food he was going to eat. And in simple sentences, just told him what to expect, beginning, middle, and end. And that was incredibly helpful to him, because people with autism often need a bit more structure.
Yes. They need their expectations set ahead of time.
Right.
Sure. And this sounds like a great idea. Now, give me some more context, if you don't mind. Did you draw pictures? Did you take pictures for magazines? Did you put photographs? How did you kind of create these? And then did you, you know, if someone wants to do this, is it something that you kind of sort of scribbled together, or is something you spent a lot of effort, you know, kind of putting it together?
I mean, I think you can do it however you do it. You know,
mm-hmm.
The first ones are kind of crude. I cut turkeys out of magazines, and I, you know, also cut up some photos.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, when we want to make one, we have a digital camera, and we just download those pictures with text from the computer, and it looks so much more professional, but it's the same thing. And they don't take that long. It's really, you know, whatever pictures you don't mind pasting in, and you staple it together, and, you know, a few lines of text. The important thing is to try to think like your child and think, you know, what are the words that he will hear and how will he hear it? You know, what will comfort him?
Right.
So for us it was just, Nat might feel scared,
mm-hmm.
but it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's all over, we'll get in the car and go home. And any time I say that, he feels good.
Yeah, I suppose just knowing what also is comforting to somebody, you can let them know ahead of time.
Right.
You know, that is going to be part of the process. That's a really great idea. Did you come up with that on your own, or did somebody help you with that concept?
I came up with that. You know, I just was sort of complaining to Ned that there weren't any good Thanksgiving books out there way back when, and he said, why don't you just make one then? And so I did, but it turns out this is a common practice for kids on the spectrum, just the social story in any form. I mean, in school, nowadays, they might just type one out for Nat. Like, if he's going to go watch an Ice Capades show,
mm-hmm.
they might say, you know, what he's going to see and how calmly he's going to sit, and he's going to take the bus, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So it's a common practice, but to sort of personalize it with pictures of the kid and everything, That was what made it unique, and I think that helped tremendously for Nat to see himself in a book.
Right, Huh. Any other ideas like that? Any tips or?
Well, nowadays, instead of that, we have a calendar that we make for him where we just write out the highlights of each day. So he can kind of at a glance see if this is a day with school in it and a day, and who's going to come visit him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, today it will say Sean, it will say school and Sean, and Sean is our sitter who works with him, and Sean, that means Sean's going to come and go running with him.
Mm.
So he'll kind of just know that that's what to expect today, and that's kind of all he needs.
Mm-hmm.
So the calendar, and we used to use, in fact, we still do use Velcro boards with a whole lot of choices of activities that he can choose, and he can kind of schedule his own day
mm-hmm.
with. Like the little Velcro tabs will say, watch a video, eat lunch, clear the table, take a shower, all those kinds of choices. And he arranges his day, and that really helps him also. And that's when he's having tough times. We don't really use that as much as we used to.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It does sound like you have done quite a bit of creative thinking to really come up with what you found was going to work best for Nat. What do you think newly diagnosed families need to know the most?
I think that, I mean, the three things that I think are the most important to keep in mind are that once they're informed about autism, that they're the experts on their child. They're the best experts and the best advocate that child will ever have. The next thing that they should know is that they shouldn't be afraid to be as creative and as eccentric as they need to be. And then the last thing is that a happy family doesn't necessarily look the way you once expected it to look.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you're newly diagnosed, I think that knowing those kinds of things can give you a sense of hope and empowerment, and that's really what you need to really figure out your kids and to figure out your family style and then what you're going to do to get to your goals.
Right. Talk about some of the more difficult points. You talk in your book about one family story of struggle, discovery, and unexpected gifts. What were some of those low points, and if you don't mind sharing, and how you overcame them? I think it can really help other people at the same place.
I think one of the worst times was when Nat was around 7 and suddenly stopped sleeping in the night and would wake up in the middle of the night laughing hysterically and couldn't go back to sleep. So we had about 6 months of no sleep, essentially. Mm. I mean, there would be nights where he would stay asleep, but it was unpredictable. So we were living with tremendous stress of never knowing when we were going to be awakened,
mm-hmm.
like when you have a newborn.
Right.
And the problem was the doctors we consulted with really had no good advice for us. A whole lot of mixed messages like, you need to, you're being too soft on him. One doctor said, you have to stand by the door and hold the door so he just stays in bed because he didn't like the door closed.
Mm.
Or one doctor had us try melatonin crushed into an Oreo, into the cream of an Oreo because it was hard to give him any medicine.
Right.
The thing is, I mean, melatonin works sometimes, but it doesn't always. And
right.
Ultimately, this led us to trying medication for him, which was very scary. We didn't want to have to go into drugs and things like that when he was only 7, but we were assured that clonidine, which is the drug that finally helped, clonidine had very few side effects and has been around for a long time, and when we've tried it, it worked immediately and has since then. So, you know, still not being thrilled with the fact that he's got to be on medication, I would say that was the thing that saved us at that point.
Right. Just a quick aside, this is definitely not a conversation about biochemical treatments or anything, approaches, so I'm not going to really belabor it, but for people that are out there, definitely look at everything that all the different perspectives have, that Western medicine has to offer, what other approaches might have, because that's actually a pretty common symptom is to have sleeping issues, and I definitely have clients that have been dealing with what you went through for quite a long time, and just know that in addition to what works for you, sometimes that doesn't work for people, you know, because we all have different chemistry, but that there are, if you look into the biomedical approach, there are things about yeast overgrowth, food sensitivities, phenol reactions, and again, I'm not going to go into them, and that's not the purpose of this interview, but just so people know, definitely try lots of approaches and get as many perspectives as you can, because there are definitely ways of working with these, and whatever your final approach is that works for you, you know, sometimes we need a little bit of extra assistance with some of these things, because yeah, sleep deprivation can be difficult on everybody in the family. So,
right, and in fact, my point, too, is it certainly isn't something I'm just recommending, but my point is that we probably waited too long before we started looking around for help, and I think that if families really start to feel that kind of stress that we did, they should really try as hard as it is to call around and see what support groups and doctors and therapists and people you respect recommend, and keep going till you find an answer that really suits your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just kind of, I don't know, we were just trying things that weren't right for too long, and, you know, or hoping it would go away, and there's no reason to suffer like that.
Right. I definitely agree with that. Anything else? What was the... When in these low points, did you have any important perspective or belief or outlook or something that kept you going? Because I'm assuming that there were times where you probably felt pretty upset, hopeless, whatever those things might be. I don't know what emotions you felt, but you know, maybe you can share a little bit about what those emotions were. And then did you have some particular hope or overriding belief that really helped you get through some of those difficult times?
I think that the worst time was when Nat was around 11 and was expelled from a program for aggressive behavior, and ultimately it was probably because of a combination of things. The wrong program, the wrong medication, a lot of different things, maybe his diet. But he lost his placement, and it was a terrible time. And he got worse at home, and I was just like losing my mind and terrified of him, because I had Ben at that time, who was my youngest, who was a baby, and Nat was going after me, pinching me, pulling hair, that kind of thing, and we were really afraid, and started considering sending him to residential school or even hospitalization at one point, and I think that. What happened was we felt so horrible about doing that, about the possibility of doing that, that we decided that we were going to just get through it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it sort of sounds crazy in some ways, but I think we just at that moment we committed to him in a new way, and we just knew that we were going to find a way out of it, and we were going to get through it, and we did. I mean, we had help. The behaviorist came in. And helped, and our psychiatrist helped us with a different medication, and a new school placement opened up. A combination of things made it better, and that taught me that these bad times pass if you can get through them. I mean, it's very tricky.
Uh-huh.
But what we realized during that same phase, when he was being aggressive, he was mischievous, he was laughing at people. It was really hard to live with him. There was an evening where I was just sitting on the couch with him, and I was feeling kind of relaxed, and he was just very giddy, laughing, and at first I thought, oh, there he goes, trying to annoy me again, and then I looked at him, and suddenly my heart just melted, and I just suddenly realized then and there that he was laughing like that to get me to look at him and to connect with me. And when I kind of realized it just in the bottom of my heart that so much of what he does must be about connecting, but in an extremely awkward, in the wrong way. He just doesn't know
right.
how to do it right. He gets his signals crossed. he's not wired typically.
Right.
And I guess that what that did is that lightened me in a way that, that I could feel compassion for him and then respond in a genuinely happy, giggly way and started tickling him. And then the whole thing just became this really nice interaction between us. And since then, we've been able to Ned and I both have been able to respond that way more often than not, just by kind of reminding ourselves he's doing this to connect with us.
Right.
And it gives you the compassion that you need to do your job as the parent.
Sure. Yeah. I have a family member who had a stroke, and sometimes the caregiver understandably is frustrated and says, you know, why are you doing this to annoy me? And once you can really get back to not being as frustrated, you can see that that obviously is not what they're trying to do. They're not out there to get at you. But, boy, when there's a lot of stress and there's three kids in the family and there's all these things going on, it's easy for one moment to have that thought flash through your mind until you can kind of come back to say, okay, no, he's doing the best that he can here. What might he be trying to tell me?
Right.
So,
it's
yeah.
True. I just think the stronger the parent can be, you know, the more centered you can be, the more available you are to parenting your kid. And, I mean, it's very hard to get centered when you have all this stuff going on.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I know. It's like the most important thing to do, yet it's one of the most difficult things. You mentioned in your title unexpected gifts. What are some of those unexpected gifts that you discovered that maybe you wouldn't have found otherwise?
Probably to really love the small triumphs, the small successes that families have all the time. It's hard for us to take anything for granted now, and more I'm happy about that. I feel blessed by that because I see families with typical kids getting mired down in things that they maybe they don't have to be if they could just sort of step back and realize that, you know, you don't get a certain thing when you have a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a Hallmark card. It's just life and it's very complex. And when you realize that what you have is unique and special, I think that when you really realize that and you embrace it, I think that you can find a lot more moments for happiness even with something like autism. Because you just realize that it's yours, and it's fine. It doesn't have to be what you thought originally.
Right, right. There's a story, and I'm not remembering it now, but it basically talks to that same point that it might not be what you dreamed of that would be, you know, the perfect situation or the perfect child or the perfect family, but we all know that perfect doesn't exist anyway, and if we spend our time focusing on that, what we're lacking in that area, we can miss some of those joys. And, you know, we all know people that seem to have everything yet they're not happy, and, you know, part of that, of course, is what we tend to focus on and how we perceive or what we believe about all the little things, and just really appreciating and having gratitude for all those little things in our everyday life. Do you know, I don't know if this is necessarily part of the book, I didn't see it in there, but is there, you know, a lot of times I see that these kids, they just function differently, not wrong, but just differently in terms of the way that their brain works. Many of them tend to be very creative and right brain. Some of them tend to be very, very logical. And have you noticed that in that? Have you noticed anything that you were able to say, he might be different, but these are some of the strengths that he has, and been able to really work with him to develop any of the activities that he really enjoys?
Yeah, we've been able to capitalize on his love for predictability and for order. It might be because he's a Scorpio, too. but I think that, for instance, his room is very neat, and I'm very grateful for that because he's 15, and so that's rare for a boy. And he also really likes putting things away. And what we've done is we've worked with his school to start training him to possibly work in a library.
Mm.
So I feel like what you do, what we've done is we kind of just watch him and figure out who he is. And I see that order and memorization and really liking before, during, and after of everything is kind of a, I think of it as a skill of his.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can even tell if he thinks I'm driving the wrong way, I can tell by how he's acting. And so then I think, oh, maybe I'm lost. And it's helpful to have him understand those kinds of things, maybe even better than I do.
Right. Wow, that's really great. It's great to be able to see that. What, you know, your book, How to Making Peace with Autism, kind of wrap it up for me. How did that process of actually making peace with autism happen? Was it gradual? Is it something that you look back on now and realize that you'd been doing all along but didn't realize it? What does that feel like to you?
It's more been we've had these bursts. In the same way that Nat has had bursts of development, we've had these bursts of understanding him, and they've often happened at the same time. Where Ned and I, my husband and I, both kind of figured out this thing about how we have to really be there for him. We have to be committed and calm and accepting in order to get him to give us his best behavior. You know, that's our kind of our latest realization. But it's always changing. I think that at first our journey was about figuring out what school to put him in and were we doing enough? And all the parents go through this. Mm-hmm. Am I doing enough? What therapies, what approaches do I try? And how do I know when to stop? And then you get to a point, I don't know how it happens exactly, but I've seen it. I know so many parents of older autistic kids, they get to a point where they let go of some of that, and they're living more in the moment, and they're really kind of tickled by their child, and they're not into kind of changing him to the point where they're not trying to kind of make him normal anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They're accepting him the way he is and trying to make him as good as he can be with the autism, as improved as he can be.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these kids improve so much that they lose their diagnosis. Others, they only improve to the point where they're not destroying your house anymore. But improvement happens. It really does come.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a sense of peace at some point in the process. And then you begin, I think you begin to enjoy the child just for who he is.
Right. How are Max and Ben with this at this point in their lives? They're 13 and 7 now. Are they, I don't know, what do they think about this whole thing?
Max has sort of grown up with Nat and as his brother, very close in age, and is a nurturing, very empathic person to begin with. So he's adjusted pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
On the whole. We've gotten him to talk about his feelings, and I think we've done a pretty good job of helping him figure out, you know, what's special about himself, and not in terms of autism or not autism. You know, it's not like Max is the normal one and Nat's the autistic one. It's really that there's Max and there's Nat. Really try to help him figure out who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And what are his strengths, like movie making and computer programming. So I'd say for Max, things have been okay so far, and he seems to be kind of loving and protective of Nat.
Mm.
For Ben, it's been much harder. Ben is 8 years younger and is very passionate and sees things very black and white, and I think where Ben is right now, it doesn't make sense at all that he has a brother like this.
Mm.
I think he's angry about it, and we can see it in the things he draws.
Mm-hmm.
And the remarks he makes, and we have him in play therapy now.
Mm.
With a therapist, and I think that was a really good move.
Yeah.
We began to see differences. We began to see him be a little more fluid in how he took in things that Nat said and did. He's still kind of critical, and I think that some of that is going to change. Is developmental. I think he's going to get there, but he's not there yet, and it's very hard for him, and it's hard for us because we have to really try to validate his feelings, and sometimes it's hard to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Wow. Well, it sounds like you are doing an outstanding job of just really doing your best, being present where you are, loving everybody for who they are, and you know, also letting them express all the stuff that isn't so fun. That's really important to having a cohesive family or just a family, you know. How do people get a hold of you? Do you have some contact information, website?
Yes, it's SusanSenator.com.
And how can they order your book? Do they order it there, or is it on?
Oh, it's there or on Amazon.com. They can order it now. It'll be out at the end of August 30th.
Oh, great. So
in all the bookstores, too.
Oh, wonderful. And it's called Making Peace with Autism, One Family's Story of Struggle, Discovery, and Unexpected Gifts, Susan Senator. Well, Susan, thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you.
It was really, really wonderful. I'm so excited to just have this very, very important perspective to help support parents that are at all different stages of this process. And I think this is a really empowering, important topic. I really appreciate you sharing all of your very personal family struggles with me so that we could share it with other people that might be feeling that same thing. So thank you very much.
Oh, it was really a pleasure.
This is Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant. You are listening to KPOO San Francisco, Healthful Living's radio show, Reality Sandwich. Stay tuned every Thursday at noon. We will be back next week. Thank you so much for listening.